You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gay adoption, open marriages, blended families, sperm donation, working wives and house husbands. There's no question about it. The face of the American family is changing. Rebecca Walker celebrates the many different incarnations of the American family in a new compilation of essays that she's called One Big Happy Family. 18 writers talk about polyamory, open adoption, mixed marriage, house husbandry, single motherhood, and other realities of truly modern love. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm pleased that it has brought Ms. Walker to my show, along with Asha Bandeli and Liza Monroy, both of whom contributed essays to the book. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Rebecca,
we're thrilled to be here, Leonard.
And Rebecca, you say you grew up in a non-traditional family that you describe as having been dysfunctional. Is that what got you thinking about how other non-traditional families get along?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I have alluded to it being dysfunctional, but I think in this book I'm really committed to talking about it as a family that was just not able to gel psycho-emotionally as a family. And
I would call that dysfunctional.
Well, yes, but dysfunction has a lot of judgment, and I want to be generous to not just my parents, but to all the parents who have loved each other and tried very hard to make it work and haven't been able to without kind of putting this huge burden of their idea of failure and delinquency on top of it.
Well, what was it about your family that was unconventional?
Well, they were an interracial couple. My dad was from Brooklyn, a nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn. My mom was from the Deep South, African American, and they met in Mississippi during the Civil Rights Movement and fell in love and got married when it was illegal to do so. And so they were interracial. They were both first generation college educated. They came from very different regional backgrounds, very different cultural backgrounds. So they were trying to build a very big bridge on a lot of different levels.
Did that make for something rich or something difficult to reconcile?
Both, absolutely both. I think they both come from such incredibly dynamic backgrounds, and so there was a lot going on there that was beautiful and brilliant and all of that, but it was also very hard. You know, there wasn't a lot of language to help them negotiate those differences, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this book, to help give non-traditional families the language that they need, the support that they need to make it work.
So when you decided to do this book, did you make up a list of all the possible non-traditional family situations you could imagine and then find writers and stories to include in the book?
I absolutely did. And I also reached out to some of my favorite writers, and Asha Bandeli, who's there with you, is definitely one of my favorite writers writing today. And Liza, I read a piece by her in a magazine in a doctor's office and really loved her sensibility and her writing, and so I reached out to her. I think all collections have, for me, have had that kind of synergy. It just kind of evolved in that way.
Well, do you think these stories of unconventional love all share some sort of common thread?
Well, I wanted to focus on families that made very conscious decisions about the way they were coming together, because what I ultimately gleaned from this book is not just love is everywhere and every family loves each other and love is looks a lot of different ways, which is true, but also that it's very important to be conscious of the decisions we make within our love lives and within our own emotional realities, and to not just be led along by some idea, a romantic idea or an unconscious replaying of our childhood lives. And what I love about each of the essays in the book is that the writers really do consider the choices they're making, and they make them, after a lot of deep thought. And again, Asha's piece about deciding to become a single mother is one of the most moving pieces, and it's clear that she's really put so much thought. So again, this consciousness about the choices we make, not just being hurled into our decisions, is one of the things that I think is runs through the book and the things I wanted to highlight.
So let me talk to Asha. Asha, how did you meet and fall in love with Rashid? He's a man who's serving a life sentence in prison for murder, isn't he?
Yeah, that's true. I was volunteer teaching at a prison many, many years ago, and I met Rashid along with a number of my friends who were with me, and we became very, very close. And after about 5 years, we got married, and about 5 years after that, I became pregnant. But I think it's important to say that Rashid was very young, and what I guess I can sort of loosely term almost like a gang kind of crime. And so the person I met, I never experienced him as a killer. I experienced him as a man seeking to transform.
But there's no possibility he'll ever get out, is there?
He actually has, at this juncture, made parole. What's holding him up is that he's from Guyana, and he has a deportation case over him, and that's essentially what led to the dissolution of our marriage, because that couldn't keep sort of being on the treadmill with him. But I also had his daughter.
What did your family and friends think about your decision to marry him?
I didn't tell my parents for a very long time. Some of my friends were supportive, others were questioned it greatly. I think, as I would if someone came and said, oh, I'm marrying somebody in prison, I think that anybody would question that.
You can't have a big church wedding.
There wasn't a big church wedding. And, my parents, I come from a very traditional, unlike Rebecca, very traditional background. Parents been married 55 years. They're academics. I was a little college girl, always the prodigy, graduated high school at 15, the good girl. So I think that this sort of went against the grain in very many ways.
So how do you establish some kind of a married life with someone who's in prison?
Well, in New York State, it's made somewhat easier because we were allowed to have pretty regular conjugal visits, and plus...
In a trailer.
Yeah, in a trailer on the prison ground.
Must have felt like New Orleans after Katrina.
Actually, which is sad. They actually looked better than some of the trailers I saw in New Orleans, which is pretty sad. But, but I could see him twice a week. We could talk on the phone every night, and it actually became very intense because he didn't have football games or boxing matches, all the other things men distract themselves with. We didn't have that. We just had a very clear emotional path and relationship.
But people do make judgments about women who marry men in prison.
Sure.
They stereotype them, don't they?
Well, sure, and I think that there are some of us who don't do any favors for ourselves getting on TV, Jerry Springer and the like, and acting like buffoons. So I think that it cuts both ways. There are women who will sometimes marry, like, Scott Peterson, and all you know about him is that he killed his wife and sold fertilizer.
Sounds attractive.
Exactly. So I think that there are, we don't service ourselves in that way either, but there's 2.2 million people in prison, so the landscape of who those women are is quite varied.
My guests are Asha Bandeli and Liza Monroy, two contributors to a book edited by my third guest, Rebecca Walker, called One Big Happy Family. It's published by Riverhead Books. Liza, you had a different kind of non-traditional marriage. Tell us about your friendship
indeed
with Razi.
Well, Razi and I met in film school as undergraduates, and I instantaneously fell in love, but not in the traditional sense. He became my gay best friend pretty much right away, which I think is a special kind of relationship that women and gay men share, and certain ways that they can bond that other types of relationships necessarily can't. So we met in film school, and he was the producer of a short film that I directed. We were put together on the project, and from then on, we were pretty much inseparable. And he is from Beirut, and at the end of his student visa, he couldn't get sponsored for a job in the entertainment industry, and we were living in L.A. at the time. So I offered to marry him. To help him, to keep him in the country, but not only because, you need a visa, I'll help you with that, but because we were like brother and sister by that point.
What was your marriage? What was the wedding like?
We were married by an Elvis impersonator in Las Vegas. So very fitting. It was planned kind of at the last minute, though, as Rebecca said, it was kind of a carefully considered, very much discussed decision. But we road tripped out to Vegas from L.A. and got married in the little white wedding chapel like Britney Spears.
Well, I asked Asha how her family reacted. In your case, your mother was a consular officer in charge of citizenship services at a Mexico City embassy. Weren't you worried that you'd get in trouble?
Oh, yeah. I didn't tell her.
You were the kind of person that she went after.
Exactly. So that added a level of irony to the situation. But I never planned to tell her. And she did find out. She found out when we were investing together in a co-op. And since co-op boards in New York City look at everything, our documents were all compiled, and she noticed that Rozzy was on my tax returns. So,
how long had you been married?
We had been married for over 2 years by that point.
And you never told your mother?
No. And so this was how she found out. He had already gotten his green card because he won the diversity visa lottery, so he ended up not getting it through our marriage. So when she found out, she was very angry, and she couldn't understand. And then even till today, she tells me not to write about this because I could get in trouble with DHS, Homeland Security, and I argue. But no, of course not. I married him for love. I needed him. I needed to keep him here. So,
how did Rozzy's parents react to the marriage?
They were very excited about it. His father hoped that we would fall into traditional love and have children, so he would ask about that. And Rozzy was not out of the closet. In their culture, it was absolutely not accepted. He could have been beaten or killed. So he
was that one of the fears that he had about going back to Lebanon?
Absolutely. That was the main reason why he didn't want to go back. So if I could help him stay in the country and save him from potential real harm, then I don't see how it could be criminal.
But I'm not sure whether this was a marriage of convenience or whether this was something deeper.
I think I would argue that it was definitely deeper. I, similar to Rebecca, came from a non-traditional family background. My parents knew each other for 3 months when they married. They met on a boat in Italy, and my father was an Italian waiter, so without a traditional family situation too, I'd always found myself searching for substitute brothers and sisters, and he was the closest relationship I'd ever had. He was like a brother to me, so it was deeper to me than like a Will and Grace on steroids.
Well, what sorts of challenges did you face as a married couple?
Definitely negotiating how we would handle dating life. For example, I got my first job since we were in our early 20s, and I had to fill out, you know, that I was married on tax forms, and people around the office knew I was married, but then I wanted to date someone from work. So how would we negotiate that? Would I say I was married for real, so to speak, or would I explain the situation to people? And definitely we wanted to keep it as much, you know, looking like a traditional marriage as possible, so it definitely affected.
Well, you couldn't bring people home, and he couldn't bring people home.
Right. We would kind of date on the side.
Rebecca, Liza's may not have had a sexual relationship, but she seemed to have a happy marriage with him. Jenny Block, another one of the essayists in your book, writes of her decision to have a poly marriage. Can you tell us about her?
I can, but and before I do that, I just want to remark on Liza's relationship, because I do think it's important to underline or underscore the fact that it wasn't necessarily a marriage of convenience, and that there are people all over the country now who are pushing for the recognition of not just domestic partnerships within gay marriages, but actual domestic relationships that are sanctioned by the state that provide the benefits of marriage between any two people who want to be connected in that way. So she's not alone, you know, in this realm of people who feel that they want to be very deeply committed and recognized as such. I think there's a group that's especially active in Boston that's trying to have friendships recognized at that level. So I think, again, you know, families, the idea of families is really undergoing a major transformation in our country. And then to bring up Jenny's...
Well, we're going to hold off on Jenny for a moment because we have to go to a little break. We'll come back to her and some of the other non-traditional arrangements that you have come up with in this book. There are 18 essays, writers all talking about various kinds of arrangements, polyamory, open adoption, mixed marriage, house husbandry, single motherhood. The book is called One Big Happy Family, and Rebecca Walker, who is talking to us from Hawaii, how nice for you, and in our studio, Asha Bandeli, and Liza Monroy. We'll be back with all of them right after this. We're back with in studio Asha Bandeli and Liza Monroy, two of the contributors to a new book called One Big Happy Family. 18 writers talk about polyamory, open adoption, mixed marriage, house husbandry, single motherhood, and other realities of truly modern life. It's published by Riverhead Books. With us from Hawaii, lucky her, is Rebecca Walker, who edited the book and supplied its introduction. And Rebecca, you suggested earlier that one of your major considerations beyond the unconventional relationship side of this thing is that you wanted good writers.
Yes, absolutely. I always want good writers. And I feel really, you know, grateful that I have so many in the book. But also in all my collections, I'm looking for great writing, but I'm also looking for great story, which means that I often, you know, go off the track, the literary track, and, you know, I could meet someone on a train or on a plane who has a great story, and even though they're not a writer by trade, I'll ask them to write their story for me, and that's because I feel that they are emotionally connected to the choices they've made, because they're honest, because I think that they have a story that people will really relate to. And that actually is what happened with the sperm donor dad or person. I knew him in a completely different realm. And, you know, he told me his story, and I thought it was fascinating, and I asked him to take the time to answer some questions. And we came up with his essay about how he decided to give one of his friends his sperm so that she could fulfill her wish to have a child and become a mother. And it's one of my favorite pieces in the book, and it's also, I would say, the least literary, but the most, I won't say the most, but one of the, you know, one of the very powerful pieces in the book.
Well, you do have some very well-known writers here. ZZ yes. Packer, for example, Neil Pollack, Dan Savage, the two guests I have in the studio here, Asha Bandeli and Liza Monroy. Liza was here not long ago to talk about her novel. Yeah. I had no idea that she had had this other side to her life. So, yeah. But America seems to be really interested in unconventional families. After all, Big Love is a big hit on HBO, isn't it?
Yes, I love Big Love. It's one of my favorite shows.
Is polygamy one of the things discussed here, or would that have required a 19th writer?
Well, someone asked me yesterday on an interview why I didn't have a Mitt Romney-esque family. And you know, sure, I actually, you know, could have tried to find a Mormon polygamist writer. But what I chose was to find a self-defined polyamorous writer.
And now, what does that mean?
That means someone who is open to having relationships with more than one person. And, you know, there are now, you know, millions of sites, you know, millions of hits on polyamory on the web, and I don't know how many families would consider themselves polyamorous, but there's a polyamory movement happening right now that's similar to the gay and lesbian, bisexual, curious, it's all these different letters that I now cannot remember anymore, but that was happening 30 years ago. I think they are really pressing to be recognized and accepted. You know, men who have a wife and a husband, a woman who has, you know, as the case in our book, a woman who has both a very committed relationship with a woman and who has been married to her husband for many, many years. And it's a wonderful piece. I mean, it's honest, it's sexy, it's psychologically probing. You know, the married couple has a daughter, and I think the writer really deals well with talking about the implications that the relationship will have on their daughter.
Is a suggestion?
You know, again, these are.
Is a suggestion here that what might shock one person seems to work for somebody else?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Is a suggestion that what might shock one person would really work for somebody else? Because many of these relationships seem to be pretty solid.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the book is about, you know, how, you know, the nuclear, traditional, heterosexual, Christian family is just one of many options, and in many ways our culture has colonized our own sense of love and our own sense of partnership and our own sense of what it means to be related to one another. We've been all stuffed into one model that has really proven to be, you know, at least, you know, half the time, you know, fairly unsuccessful in the long run. So to open it up and to shine a light on all the ways that people can love, the inner freedom, you know, the humanness that all of us have that's intrinsic is what allows us to love other people and to love differently. And I think that's what I want to show, and that's what I hope to unleash in all human beings, because we need that now. We need to have our love, whatever it looks like, supported.
Now, Asha, you, as we established earlier, you married Rashid, who was in prison, a life sentence. Did you ever consider having a child with him?
I never considered having a child with him while he was incarcerated. I knew other women did it. I didn't think that I had the wherewithal. I was right. But
you mean bring up a child mother?
As a single mother and negotiating prisons at the same time. But I think, you know, when I did get pregnant, it was very much a surprise. I thought I was being careful. And I was 32. You know, I didn't know if I'd have another chance. And it really was probably the best and hardest decision that I've ever made. It certainly made my marriage more complex. And I wasn't able to hold that together, but being a mother is something I've always wanted to do, and it's the happiest thing I've ever done in my life.
What did you think your child's life would be like without having her father around? She'd have to visit him in prison.
Well, initially, we had assumed that Rashid would be home right away. He'd done what was called good time. The trial judge in his case, the prosecutor and his trial attorney all supported his release. We had no idea that he was going to face deportation charges. So I never thought that that would be something she'd have to deal with a lot. We found that out 3 months after she was born, and that's really what led to the dissolution of the marriage. So I didn't know I'd have to.
Had the laws changed? Is that one of the reasons why he was going to be deported, or would that have happened in 1950 and 1960 as well?
No. The law changed in 1996 under then-President Clinton, which essentially made Rashid ineligible to even ask to stay in the country.
Mm. So was he supportive during the pregnancy?
Oh, yeah. Rashid was very, very supportive. We were very close, as you know, as we still are good friends now. She talks to my daughter, speaks to her dad all the time, you know, called all the time, did what he could to send money to me when he could, encouraged his family to be supportive of me. He's a very gentle, good and loving man.
But now he's in Guyana?
No, not yet. He's been fighting the case, and so he's here. And he actually won his deportation case, and it's being challenged by the government, but I have every belief he'll be home this year.
And if he wins, would you consider remarrying him?
I think he's going to have to court me this time on this side. I think he's going to have to court me. I've been doing it one way for quite some time now.
Well, you'd have to go buy a trailer. Liza, what happened when Razi won the visa lottery? Now that he had a visa, he no longer needed to be married.
Right. He didn't need to be married. He was on the track to getting his visa without me, but we stayed married. We liked our arrangement. We were living together. We were happy with each other, and we had outside relationships, romantic relationships, but we saw no reason to not keep things as they were.
But you didn't remain married?
No, we ultimately divorced because of the situation with the co-op and my mother that I mentioned briefly before. We might not have been able to get the co-op if I'd been married to him still. So for then that reason, we divorced.
And did that cause a lot of trouble between you and your mother?
It did. It caused a rift for a while. She just couldn't understand why I would do such a thing. It seemed like a joke to her, or just something that wasn't serious, and it was hard for us to communicate about just how real and how deep this was for me, and how also in retrospect, when I look at the situation now, how strongly I feel about gays not having the right to be married, and just that a group of people still exists who don't have equal rights. Mm-hmm. I can't wrap my head around that.
Now, Rebecca, despite all of this diversity, it's still difficult for many people to let go of the concept of the nuclear family as the ideal.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And it's been so interesting to feel and to field the hostility that has come up in response to the book already.
And I suspect I'll get a fair amount of email that is angry as well. There'll probably be some comments on our show page. Well, we welcome those comments. But this remains a very serious issue in this country. It becomes a major political issue, doesn't it?
It does. But, you know, as always, I think my books tend to have some controversy around them, and I never expect it to be as controversial as it turns out to be, because I always feel that I'm looking for the human story, and that somehow the human qualities of all these stories will come through, and that people will resonate with, especially with this book, the desire to love and to love oneself and to make choices that are affirming. But yes, I think people are very resistive. But even when you look at statistics, I mean, America is changing. This book is about being a part of a bigger change that we're going through as a culture. You know, as Asha mentioned, 1 in 100 Americans is in prison. So we have 2 million children who have parents in jail. We have 5 million children in America who live with unauthorized, quote-unquote, immigrant families. We have 4 million children who are stepchildren, 2 million children who are adopted. Almost half of all parents are unmarried. 9 million Americans identify as multiracial. I mean, this is a new country. We have an African-American president, you know.
And he's mixed race as well.
That's right. He's African-American and multiracial, exactly. He's like I am. He's African American and he's European American, instead of just sort of glossing over that by saying multiracial. So I think, you know, people need to really take stock of what change means. Change means change.
Now,
it
how would
mean, you know, putting a new face on an old system? It means that we really need to change.
Well, I'm going to throw this out to all of you, but I'll begin with you, Rebecca. How would you respond to social conservatives who say that these changes are really responsible for a decline of the traditional family, of traditional family values, perhaps even of a decline of American morality?
Well, you know, I would say that we need to look, you know, conservatives generally cite the Bible, and many sort of religious conservatives, the Christian right, cite the Bible, and like Rick Warren said that, you know, for thousands of years marriage has been defined as between a man and a woman. And if you look in the Bible, what you see is there are many polygamous relationships in the Bible. And so, just at that very point, that very reference point, you'll find a very different reality. I would just start there, and I would suggest, you know, that we could look at the unregulated banking system that is really undermining America at this point. It's not people trying to love each other in new and interesting ways. It's CEOs of corporations who are taking $20 million each of the TARP bailout, you know, to the tune of $20 billion, who are really undermining this country. I mean, you know, this idea of scapegoating quote-unquote non-traditional families in the midst of much larger decisions that are being made that really put so many stresses on the American family. I mean, you know, most nuclear traditional American families can't hold together because of the pure economics of it, because of the lack of support of the middle class and working class and poor families. So I would suggest that they look at policy. I would suggest that they look at American, especially in the last 10 years, hyper-capitalist values. And yes, I mean, I'm not immune. And I would say that we could look at some individuals, you know, amidst different family configurations, and you know, there are no families are perfect, you know.
Well, Asha, you would have preferred to have had a nuclear family if the situation had worked out for you.
Absolutely, a product of my environment. I think that that was all I knew and all I saw.
Though you'd grown up in a traditional
very,
family?
Very typical, traditional, you know, down to horseback riding in summer camp every year. I mean, but now, you know, it's interesting. I actually love being a single parent and could almost not imagine having to co-parent. And, you know, I agree with everything Rebecca said. And, you know, I'd also question whether the typical American family is one that is utopia. It might be dysutopia if you read a lot of the books that are out there from, you know, The Ice Storm, just all these books that talk about what was going on in traditional nuclear American families, from incest to alcoholism. I mean, there's a lot of stories out there that suggest that this may not 100% be the best way to go. I think what we want are healthy families, and what we want are families where children are safe and where the partners are safe. And that's what I would want us to work for.
Liza, what do you imagine would have happened if you hadn't been forced to separate?
With Razi, probably would have continued living with him. And
would you have wanted to have a child, adopt a child?
We definitely discussed that if neither of us fell into traditional love or married other people of the opposite gender for me and same for him, that we would consider doing a sperm donation type situation and having a baby. And in some ways that was a fantasy, and it didn't turn out to be what was in the stars for us, but it was definitely something that we would have considered.
Do you see the nuclear family as the ideal situation?
I don't. I mean, and to me, the essays in the book are about, as Rebecca was saying, loving in new and unconventional ways and ways that redefine the family, and that, you know, conservatives or anyone critical of those kind of situations would be better focusing their energy on people who are spreading hate or committing crimes, or, you know, just doing things that aren't, you know, just recreating family and you know, exploring situations that are different than the traditional nuclear family.
Well, we're about to see some major changes, because for the first time in American history, more women are working than men. Yeah. I don't know whether that means more house husbands, because I just read an article in Newsweek which suggests that when men stay at home, they really don't do much housework. In fact, they usually do more when they are working and they're sharing the chores. They're more likely to be watching television or sitting at the computer or something like that, or sleeping late. but it's obvious that we're going to have to make other adjustments just based on the economic realities of the coming years.
Mm-hmm. And we can when we want to. Look how adjustments were made during World War II for all the women who were left here. I mean, the society moved heaven and earth to make sure women could get to work, that children were cared for. There were things that were done when society deems it ought to be done.
And then Rosie the Riveter was told to go back home and be
right.
A mom.
That's right.
In a one, and dad would go out and work.
That's right. And so I just think when we have the collective will to have a healthy society and support citizens and support our people, then I think we can do it.
Yeah. I'm also thinking, as we talk about Haggard, what was that?
Ted Haggard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a very good example of, you know, a nuclear traditional family, you know, gone terribly wrong.
Rebecca, I didn't know why you didn't have him write a piece for your book.
could have been interesting.
Actually, I would have, but I saw him on one of these reality shows, and he's living in his car, I think, and mm-hmm. And I didn't have a way to reach him. No, but you know, I think you know, there are so many examples of the ways in which these families have forced people in them to become something other than who they are, and that's been the cause of great mm-hmm. suffering.
Rebecca Walker is the editor and supplied the introduction to One Big Happy Family. 18 writers talk about polyamory, open adoption, mixed marriage, house husbandry, single motherhood, and other realities of truly modern love. It's published by Riverhead. You may want to meet my other guest, Liza Monroy. Will be giving a reading next Thursday, the 5th, at 8 o'clock at the Franklin Park Beer Garden. That's at 618 St. John's Place in Crown Heights. And I want to thank you, Liza, and I want to thank you, Asha, for being our guest as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.